This is the Financial Exchange with Chuck Zotta and Mike Armstrong. Your exclusive look at business and financial news affecting your day, your city, your world. Stay informed and up to date about economic and market trends, plus breaking business news every day. This is the Financial Exchange with Chuck Zotta and Mike Armstrong.
Well, if you didn't like yesterday's market, maybe this one's more up your alley.
It's more up my alley, Chuck.
Yesterday, we had the worst day in markets since January. Not the worst day ever, so I continue to think...
It's been the worst day in, like, 120 days.
I need to take a slight digression here, because at its worst yesterday, this market, the S&P 500... was about 3% off its highs. All-time highs, by the way. Mm-hmm. Not weekly highs, not month. All-time highs.
Yep.
3% off all-time highs. The NASDAQ was about 6% off all-time highs.
Mm-hmm.
And people thought the world was ending.
Our pets' heads were falling
off. Did we not 15 months ago go through a 35% market crash in a span of 3 weeks?
Not that I recall. I have no idea what you're talking about anymore.
How soft have we gotten that a little 2% down day makes us go, oh, the pets' heads are falling off. Our portfolio's never going to grow up. It's a market dip. It fell 2%.
Yeah, they do also go down.
We went through days last year where the Dow was significantly lower and fell 2,000 points in a single day.
Yeah, 2,000. I remember that day. That was a fun one.
2,000. It was down 600 yesterday, and the way that people were talking was like the world was ending. I was getting questions, well, does this mean we're never going to have gas again? Energy was the best performing sector yesterday. Okay, we need to have a little bit of perspective here. The world is not ending. Oh, inflation was hot. It was all in used automobiles and rental car prices. I'm not saying that there's no inflation, but I'm saying the print yesterday was all in used car prices and automobiles. So here's a question for you, Mike, that we have to ask.
Okay.
Is the best performing asset class for 2021 going to be used vehicles?
Ooh. I would say either used vehicles or homes that were previously priced under $200,000.
Because here's where we're at right now. You got to make a choice. Do you want your lumber or a used car?
You can't have both.
You can't have both. But I think
I saw somebody. I saw somebody post some stupid meme going around with somebody holding 5 toothpicks, and it was
my nest egg
lumber seeds. $75 a piece.
Well,
don't lowball me. I know what I got.
I maintain that the most valuable person in this economy right now, if you could ever have a real world version of Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy,
yeah,
just grows lumber out of the tips of his fingers.
Yeah, on demand.
But anyways, yesterday we had a hot inflation print. There's no doubt that inflation is something to be concerned about. But let's not make this into the world is ending and everything is awful here. Okay, we can't simultaneously say that it's so hot that employers can't find enough workers and then say the economy's falling apart. Both of those things can't exist.
Right, and that's what I've tried to drill home to people is, yes, we might be dealing with some inflation. I don't know if it is going to be short-term or sustained, but we wouldn't be dealing with it if we were dealing with a really weak economy. And again, I don't know what it's going to lead to with stock prices. I don't know what it's going to lead to with average salaries and people getting back to work. But none of this would be possible unless consumers were feeling pretty darn good about this economy.
We can't simultaneously have businesses saying, I have too many sales and it's too hard to hire, and say the economy's falling apart. Those two things cannot coexist simultaneously. So that's my point on this, is not that in inflation, I think it is something to potentially be concerned about. And potential, we've talked about how wage inflation can be sticky. And did you see the two big notices on wages this morning, Mike?
No.
Amazon bumping their average starting wage up to $17 an hour.
So average starting wage?
Yep. So not all, but average starting wage up to $17 an hour.
I bet they were already there. And I mean, their starting wage was already $15 an hour. Correct. So they were just announcing that.
But
this
just
is the case.
Just saying this is where it is. And McDonald's bumping their starting wage for corporate-owned stores, which is not the majority of their stores.
Yeah, very few of them.
The majority of McDonald's stores are franchised, but saying that depending on the region, entry-level wages at McDonald's, anywhere from $11, probably, you know, rural Mississippi, rural West Virginia, places like that, up to $17 an hour. So my guess is if you're in California, New York, or the New England region.
I mean, I was going to say, if you're on the Mass Pike at a McDonald's, you're probably walking in at $17.
$17 an hour. Yeah. So I think that when we talk about wage inflation and what that does to prices, I think that is absolutely something where my antenna go up and I say, yeah, we need to watch this over the next couple of years. And I had an interesting epiphany last night. Just I'm going to digress and talk a little inflation.
Let's
now.
Do it.
So,
and by the way, before you go way too deep into inflation, I do want to point out we've got a guest coming on at about in about 10 minutes from the American Institute for Economic Research, who's going to be mainly talking about inflation, too. So I'll
better
be
than I do.
He's got a PhD, so he'll be more more informed, perhaps.
Far smarter, far more qualified. That's why we're bringing him on the show. Anyways. One of the things that we saw last year was that as the pandemic hit and as we saw shutdowns hit back in March and April, median wages actually went up. Average wages went up. And the reason why was because all the low-wage workers in hospitality and travel and leisure and entertainment and all those areas, entry-level workers, got laid off or furloughed. And so we said, hey, average wages went up, but it went up because we lost all of these low-wage workers, and so the remaining workers were higher paid.
Yep.
That's what we said. And that was true. Still is true. That's exactly what happened. But the interesting thing is that we talked last week about how the restaurant industry saw a decrease in employment from about 15 million people at the end of 2019 down to about 12 million people at the end of 2020, about a 20% exodus from the restaurant industry, either voluntarily or through forced exits.
Yep.
And the interesting piece to me is that there are two areas that I think we're hearing the most chatter about labor shortages. One is restaurants. The other is in, you know, manual trades, whether it's manufacturing or construction.
Okay.
But on the restaurant one in particular, the interesting thing is, again, a lot of those people who were working in the restaurant industry, not all of them, but some of them scattered and went to work in new industries. They went to do new things. Maybe they went back to school. But in any case, a lot of people left that industry and found other things to do. So the piece that I'm getting at here is when restaurants are trying to hire workers today, they're not competing against other restaurants to do so anymore at restaurant wages. They're competing against the wages that everyone has been earning out in those other jobs and other fields. Have I been making more driving for Uber Eats? Have I been making more, you know, working, doing whatever it is that you're doing?
Yeah, driving for UPS, working at an Amazon warehouse, whatever it might be.
And so restaurants used to be able to say, hey, these are our entry-level wages, and this is how they are because we're the restaurant industry, and we've always existed this way, and yada, yada. But when you have that gap where a huge chunk of your employment stops in a short period of time, you're no longer just competing against other restaurants for that labor in the same way. You've always had to compete to a certain extent with other industries.
Mm-hmm.
But now that people have seen the wages and conditions that are available in other industries, it's much more direct competition. And that is why I think restaurants are having an awful hard time hiring, is because people have now, it's almost like how we talk about the worst thing for any service is for people to have it canceled and realize they don't miss it, right? If Netflix goes down for 2 weeks and people realize I don't really care, then Netflix has a real problem with pricing on the back end. Likewise, if a bunch of people get laid off from restaurants, find other work, and restaurants are sitting there saying, hey, come back for $2.13 an hour plus tips, a lot of people are saying, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's just something interesting that we've seen is even with restaurants being the major hiring force over the course of this spring now, you've seen what's happened to average weekly wages. They've still been going up.
Sure.
It's not something where we haven't seen average weekly wages going down because restaurants are hiring, which if they were bringing people in at the same wages last year, that's what you would expect. Average weekly wages are still moving up. Yep. And that tells me that the competition restaurants are facing is with all of these higher wages that people have moved into now.
Yeah. I mean, that and the unemployment.
And the unemployment piece.
Yeah.
And the unemployment piece.
So we just spent a few minutes being optimistic here, and I think, you know, that's fair. Markets are back up today. Dow's surging 400 and nearly 30 points right now, so I want to be optimistic about
that. But everything's not fixed today.
But no, yeah, exactly. Nothing has changed since yesterday other than some sentiment and some calming down in markets. And I think to play devil's advocate here and why I think markets were panicking yesterday is a fair concern, which is that we have not dealt with this type of economic issue of inflation in more than 40 years.
No one has a playbook for dealing with it.
Nobody's got a great investment playbook for dealing with it. And the Fed claims that they have some policy playbooks to deal with it. But I think a lot of people would call that into question. And so if you are, you know, looking at this and saying, oh, well, you know, how do we deal with an economic recession where unemployment surges to 15%? Well, turns out we knew how to deal with that problem. We dealt with it during the Great Recession, and we learned a lot, and we dealt with that. When we're talking about shortages and inflation, we might know how to deal with it. But if it is long-term in nature, then I think that's what is spooking markets, is just not a ton of great experience with that.
Yeah, it's just something where, again, the Fed's saying, hey, we can deal with inflation if it pops up. I've been saying for 10 years that I thought that the Fed moving to lower rates was a bad way to try to create, you know, to deal with deflation. They were trying to deal with the deflation of the financial crisis by saying, hey, let's, you know, low rates for longer and yada, yada. And it didn't work.
Right.
We saw no increase in economic activity because the Fed simply kept rates low. I think likewise, it's hard to look at the Fed raising rates and saying, oh, yeah, that'll just stop inflation. You know, it can't be both of those things. So I think that where I continue to stand is the Fed's tools are not the ones that you want to be used to either fight a deflationary economy or an inflationary one. I think that they can change some things around the edges as far as pricing for assets. But ultimately, labor does not become cheaper because interest rates go up. Likewise, labor does not become more expensive because interest rates go down. If it did, then wouldn't we have seen awfully expensive labor in the last 10 years?
Probably.
And we didn't. Let's take a quick break. And as we said, we're now going to be joined after this by Thomas Hogan. He's a senior research fellow at AIER. And Thomas is going to be talking about inflation as well in far more impressive terms than what I've been able to convey in this segment. So stick around, and Thomas Hogan joins us right after this.
Wall Street Watch, a full update on the market's performance to date. Weekdays at 10:30, only here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Protecting your assets becomes more important as you age. It may well be your most important financial responsibility. And if you haven't done it already, creating a trust is a great way to help. There are many types of trusts to consider, but irrevocable trusts are extremely popular to establish the kinds of safeguards you'll need. If you're ready to build a new estate plan that includes a trust, you need to call Cushing & Dolan. They have a brand new guide out this month called An Operations Guide to Irrevocable Trusts. In it, you'll learn about how the trust can potentially eliminate your estate taxes, as well as protect your assets from probate. Call 866-848-5699 and get your copy of this new guide so it can walk you through the process step by step and ensure that your trust is set up properly. That's 866-848-5699. Cushing & Dolan are experts in estate planning and taxation, and they've been helping New England families for more than 30 years. Call them today and let them help you too. Call 866-848-5699. That's 866-848-5699. Or download the guide right now by visiting LegalExchangeShow.com. If you missed any part of today's show, not to worry. Go to FinancialExchangeShow.com and click Listen. Then click On Demand and catch up on every segment. You'll also find podcasts of all of our full shows. Just punch up that Listen button at FinancialExchangeShow.com.
This segment of the Financial Exchange is brought to you in part by Southern Airways Express. Now with flights from Hanscom Field off 95, if you live north or west of Boston or in southern New Hampshire or Maine, Hanscom Field is the hassle-free way for you to get to Nantucket. Southern Airways Express, fast flights, low fares. Book today at iFlySouthern.com. We're joined now by Thomas Hogan, a senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research, here to talk to us about inflation, what we saw yesterday, and what we're likely to see going forward. Thomas, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for talk.
So clearly markets were spooked, and I don't know if they were surprised by yesterday's report, because I think everybody was expecting some inflation. But when you look through this economy today and the inflation that we are clearly experiencing right now, what concerns you and what doesn't concern you too much?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'm in a bit of an unusual position because I've actually been pretty critical of Fed policy over the last year. But when people say now that Fed policies are starting to cause high inflation, I'm just not really seeing that. You know, I think part of it is, what do we mean by high? That when I talk to non-economists, they think high inflation means double digit, you know, 10% or more inflation, like the 1970s, that we're headed into stagflation. But most economists, I think, when we're talking about high inflation, we mean, you know, maybe as high as 5%. I don't know of anyone predicting more than 5%. And quantitatively, the amount of money that the Fed's put into the economy doesn't seem right now like it would cause more than that. You know, financial markets, if we look at like the tip spread right now, they're predicting about 2.65% over the next 5 years. So, you know, that's higher than the 2% target that the Fed has. Maybe it means we'll have 3% for a couple of years and then go back to 2%. But it just seems unlikely that we would have, you know, maybe 4%, 5% at most. So that's a problem. I mean, we don't want to have high inflation like that.
Sure.
But it's sort of far from the disaster scenarios that I think a lot of people envision when we talk about high inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you, at least in your evaluation there of, you know, the Fed's impact on today's inflation. It seems to be much more caused by these shortages that we're seeing. And I, you know, furthermore, just kind of call into question the Fed's ability to create for the inflation in general. They tried for the last decade and were largely unsuccessful. You know, we have very little experience in the United States with inflation recently, and I would imagine that you can do this better than I can, but can you compare and maybe contrast a little bit what we're experiencing right now compared to the only real period in U.S. history with severe inflation, the 1970s?
So, I mean, it does seem like it's a lot different. You know, in the 1970s, the Fed was under the impression that if they just put enough money into the economy, they could create inflation, and that was going to push unemployment down.
Yep.
And so they, you know, created a lot of inflation, but then people adjusted their expectations and understood that that they were going to have higher inflation. And so businesses marked up their prices, and people started requiring a higher wage, and so that caused the unusual situation of stagflation, where we had, you know, high inflation and high unemployment. Now it's a lot different because, you know, we're in a situation where people are much more, because of that experience, much more, I think, afraid of inflation. The public is, but we're also in a situation where we have been in prior to the COVID crisis in a very good economy and currently heading back in that direction. You know, I think people are kind of misgauging what's going on in the economy right now.
Mm-hmm.
The unemployment rate has been around 6% for the last 6 months or so. And I see people looking at that and saying, you know, things are kind of getting back to normal. The long-run average unemployment rate in the U.S. is 6%. But when I look at it, what I see is that there's a huge dispersion between states. And so since back in December, you know, we had a situation where we had eight states that had unemployment of 4% or less. So that's, you know, historically low. At the national level, that's only happened three or four times since the Great Depression. But then we had another 8 or 10 that had 8% or more, which also is basically a historic high. So we have this huge split between some states that were doing very, very well and some states that were in basically big recessions. And a lot of that was because of, you know, COVID and lockdowns. And that's changed in the last 6 months, that more states have started to open up. And so as that happens, we'll see a lot of people returning to work, and we are seeing. And so it's just, you know, it's a much different situation than we had in the 1970s, where they were trying to push unemployment down. Now we have an opportunity where the economy is opening up and we have people just naturally going back to work, mostly. We've seen a spell in unemployment, right?
Yeah, I think clearly we've seen a bit of a stall here, and we'll see if that picks back up. Thomas Hogan, I think we could talk about this for another hour, but we have run out of time.
Okay.
Is the former chief economist for the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, the senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Thank you for your time. Really look forward to having you again sometime soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I think, you know, the big question again is just, do we start seeing indications of that stagflation? In Thomas's opinion, it's not there yet, but I don't think he ruled it out as a possibility in the future.
No, I think these are things that investors need to be thinking about, but there's a difference between thinking about it and putting your entire portfolio into inflation hedges. And I think that that's a distinction that's really important. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Wall Street Watch is next.
Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at TFE Show. Breaking business news is always first, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Time now for Wall Street Watch. A complete look at what's moving markets so far today, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
Don't have time to catch the entire show? Check out our new podcast called Dumb Questions for Smart Money. We'll talk about the latest economic trends and all the breaking news you want. It's Dumb Questions for Smart Money with Paul Lane and Emma David. Find it on our website, financialexchangeshow.com, and on the iHeartRadio app. It is time now for Wall Street Watch. We're joined by Paul Lane from the Armstrong Advisory Group for a look around at markets, and much better than what we saw yesterday.
Mike, it's a nice bounce back day. We're seeing the Dow Jones Industrial up 520 points or 1.5%. S&P 500 up 59 points, close to 1.5% as well. And the NASDAQ, which has been getting hit quite hard, is up 191 points. Again, pretty close to about 1.5% up on the day. The Russell 2000 is also up close to 2%. So a lot of green across the market, which we love to see after the trading day we saw yesterday. Taking a look at some of the other market indicators out there, the U.S. 10-year Treasury is relatively flat. It's at 1.67%, down 2 basis points. That had spiked up quite a bit yesterday in the market action. And if we take a look at oil, it is down 2.5% at $64 a barrel. And from a sector perspective, we're seeing technology with that rise in the NASDAQ up close to 2%. And energy is the weakest sector, but still up close to about 0.5%, Mike.
Paul, I remember talking about this company, Bumble, on the day it IPO'd. I think we actually covered it for Wall Street Watch. Came out to pretty, you know, enormous fanfare. Their competitor, Match Group, has done extraordinarily well. But I'll tell you, since IPO, this company has posted relatively impressive earnings, but stock price has not reflected terrible optimism.
Mike, there's been no love for the dating app Bumble compared to its peer Match that you mentioned. Even after they came out with their earnings yesterday, they surprised analysts with a first quarter profit that was compared to expectations of a quarterly loss. They also raised their revenue for the year as well, forecasting between $724 million to $734 million. For revenue on the year, that was above analyst expectations, but it can get no appreciation from Wall Street as it's down 6% today. And the reason for that, the stock has been down going into today 38% since that February 11th IPO that you were touching upon, is because compared to its peers, Match is its biggest competitor. It doesn't have the same amount of brands. Bumble is the second most popular dating app in the world, but it's only Bumble and one other dating app that it has, while Match has 10 different platforms, and Tinder, its most popular app for Match, is the highest grossing dating app out there. If you take a look at some of Match's brands, Hinge, for example, is another one. It's tripled its revenue last year and is on pace to double its revenue again this year, where they haven't been seeing that same type of growth from Bumble. The Apptopia data from February to May, this is a source that goes through different usages of these apps out there, has been mentioning that Match's app has grown at a much higher rate than Bumble's. And these worldwide sessions that they gauge is a good indicator of how many paid subscribers are out there. And the May run rates for Bumble were quite flat versus Tinder, that has seen double-digit growth. So if you look at the price to sales, Match for Bumble, it's only at 11 times versus some of its peers out there. It's quite expensive, and it's reflected that today in the trading action, down about 6%, Mike.
It's Paul Lane from the Armstrong Advisory Group joining us for Wall Street Watch, in particular today taking a look at Bumble. Stock's down about 6%. Ticker symbol, if you want to check them out, BMBL.
Let's talk jobless claims. Every Thursday we get a new set of weekly jobless claims, and continuing to see week-over-week declines, with this week coming in at 473,000, the second week in a row below 500,000. And this is now 5 weeks in a row below the 600,000 threshold that we previously had not breached in an awful long time. So I do think it's good that we are continuing to see new claims declining here. I think that suggests that, you know, obviously we're seeing a strengthening labor market. We still have to, you know, do the work of actually getting people into new jobs, which I think is the question that we're all asking after last Friday's jobs report. But certainly this is, you know, welcome news after a year of incredibly elevated jobless claims.
Yeah. You want to see this number declining. And as we've mentioned before, you know, below 500,000, below 500,000 new jobless claims per week, I think is pretty healthy given all the incentives to be jobless right now. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that the headline just kind of made me scratch my head. The declining jobless claims suggest hiring could pick up. And
they're not one and the same at this point.
Yeah, I mean, no, it doesn't really indicate that to me.
No.
Because if it did, then we probably would have had a monster job number in the month of April. So, you know, the declining jobless claims to me suggests that employers are laying off fewer workers, but does not indicate, and it indicates to me that employers are demanding labor and want to hire people, but whether or not they will be successful, I don't think has anything to do with the weekly jobless claims.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair way of looking at it. The only other thing that I was thinking about with regards to that April report is that last April was the month that we added all those jobs back after they dropped off in March. Remember, we had, yep, you know, 20 million jobs lost in March, and then April's when they showed back up again. And so I do think there's probably a little bit of seasonality there. But either way, even when you factor out the seasonality, I was looking at the numbers. It still was weak. There's just not enough there.
By any definition, the April jobs report,
there's no way to spin it.
It was weak. They had to revise back March. So, I mean, the fact of the matter is, look,
the May one's going to be really important.
It is, yeah. If you have a disappointing repeat in the month of May, then we've got a problem. Then you really have an indication that things are going very, very poorly for these employers. Not so much for the employees or the labor market in and of itself, but for those employers, that is a bad indication, and a bad indication for potential profit and growth for the summer. But yeah, no great way to spin it. Other than the only way I'll spin it is, economists are having a tough time guessing what this is all going to look like. I mean, we consistently are having, you know, the worst misses compared to expectations in decades, right? Whether it's CPI, whether it is, you know, job markets, number of jobs created, it's just consistently the worst compared to expectations for decades. And we're going to expect more of that.
But the interesting thing is the macro level data that we've gotten over the last week. As you mentioned, really bad misses. Like, it has not been anywhere close to what economists were expecting in a worse direction.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, earnings over the first quarter?
Better than
anyone expected by, again, unprecedented margins. So
It cuts both ways. Yeah, I did not mean to indicate that is purely a negative thing. I think what I take from it is
no one has a clue.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows what profits are going to look like. Nobody knows what labor is going to look like. Nobody knows what wages and inflation is going to look like. Everybody's guessing at this point. And so far, the guesses haven't been terribly good.
No, they've been awful. The other piece, just when we're talking about jobless claims, we did see an additional three states yesterday decide to move away from the additional 300 per week federal UI. We're now up to 12 states, which makes up about 25% of the overall U.S. in terms of number of states. But they're really tiny states.
Yeah, so we don't have Texas yet, right?
No, the 12 states that have decided to move away from the federal unemployment benefit of that 300 per week, they represent only 12% of the U.S. workforce.
Yeah.
So
you're not going to see it move the needle in the jobs.
No. When Wyoming decides to get rid of this, it doesn't matter. I'm not saying that Wyoming doesn't matter, but from an employment perspective, Wyoming doesn't matter.
Yeah, and by the way, I think some of the majority of these states, in fact, everyone that I looked at when it was just nine states, had unemployment rates that were below the national average.
Right.
So, you know, the possibility of adding a whole bunch of new employees in those states is, you know, not all that feasible to begin with.
When's the last time you took a look at state-level unemployment rates?
I haven't in a little while.
Do you know what the highest unemployment rates are currently? Remember, Massachusetts was awful for the longest time.
Yeah, so I'm going to go California.
California is number five, currently clocking in at 8.3%. And this is using the March data. We don't have the April data loaded in on a state level yet.
New York or New Jersey in the top 10?
New York is second at 8.5%. Oh. New Jersey is eighth at 7.7%.
Ohio?
Ohio is middle of the pack at about 4.7.
All right, I'll shut my mic off.
No, that's okay. You can be wrong. Everyone's wrong right
Wyoming.
Now.
Wyoming.
No, Wyoming is, how do you find Wyoming? There it is, 5.3%.
Washington State, number one?
Washington is 5.4%.
Who's number one?
For still the highest level of unemployment? Hawaii!
I should have guessed. Yeah, tourism, duh.
9% unemployment in Hawaii, New Mexico, Connecticut, California, Nevada, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Rhode Island, Illinois, and Texas, rounding out the top 10.
Texas. I mean, I guess they're not an oil economy anymore, and so that is, you know, I immediately when I think Texas, I say oil prices are through the roof, employment should be good, but I know that that's not the case anymore. It's a lot more tech these days, so maybe I'm just misreading that economy.
Texas's unemployment rate right now is 0.1% above Massachusetts, knocking it out of the top 10.
Wow.
Then you go Arizona, Alaska, Delaware, Colorado, Mississippi, Maryland, Oregon, West Virginia, Washington, Wyoming for your top 20.
And, you know, by the way, when you factor, so Massachusetts has some of the most generous unemployment benefits in the entire country. I did the math out for a 40-hour work week, the weekly unemployment, if you're maxing out your weekly unemployment, it was more than $25 an hour.
Was it?
And we're not registering in the top 10 here. So I merely indicate that, you know, the jobless benefits, the, you know, unemployment insurance that is being paid out is a factor. But if you're one of these 12 states that's getting rid of it, don't anticipate that it's going to just solve all of your problems for your companies. There are additional problems than just the unemployment benefits.
Now, there's a really weird convergence of states that have the lowest unemployment rates in the country.
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be no correlation between
Nebraska, South Dakota. You say, okay, rural, you know, not Midwest, well, kind of Midwest, almost Midwest.
Plains.
Utah. Yeah. Vermont and New Hampshire. Don't really fit there at all. Idaho, Iowa. Okay, more Midwest. Kansas, Alabama, Montana, Wisconsin, Indiana. So I guess a lot of Midwest states fall into that category, which is interesting given the fact that the Midwestern states have had horrible economies for much of the last decade.
They were all largely rural states, no states with huge cities.
Yep, no states that are huge tourist destinations.
Right.
You know, so I guess you could say that.
Right.
Because you do look at the states that have high levels of unemployment, aside from Connecticut's not really a tourist destination.
No.
No. Hawaii, absolutely. New York, New York City, sure. New Mexico, I don't really know what the economy of New Mexico looks like, if I'm being honest.
Chili peppers.
California, big tourist. Nevada, huge tourist with, you know, Las Vegas. Washington, D.C., big tourist destination. New Jersey, the shore.
I'm just going to keep my comments to myself.
Just a quick follow-up, by the way. I know we mentioned Amazon hiking their average pay to $17 an hour. Just broke that they are also hiring 75,000 more workers and are offering $1,000 signing bonuses in some locations.
Drop in the bucket. They hired 500,000 last year.
Yeah, what's 75,000? 3 days?
Yeah.
Come on, Jeff, speed it up.
$1,000 signing bonus.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the restarting of the Colonial Pipeline after this.
Business news, financial news, and what it means to you on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
How much money should you be withdrawing from your portfolio each year to live comfortably in retirement? Is 4% enough? Hi, this is Barry from the Armstrong Advisory Group. The 4% rule has history, but it may not be a strategy that works for you. The rule is based on different assumptions, such as consistent rates of spending during your retirement, and it applies to a specific portfolio makeup that is split right down the middle between stocks and bonds. A 4% yearly withdrawal might sound good, but a rule of thumb is not a strategy. Our brand new guide out this month is called Is the 4% Withdrawal Rule Dead?, which may help you determine which withdrawal rate might be best for you. Get your free copy of this guide today by calling 800-393-4001. That's 800-393-4001. You can also download the guide right now at armstrongadvisory.com.
Securities offered through Securities America Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC, and advisory services offered through Securities America Advisors Incorporated. Michael Armstrong, representative. Armstrong Advisory Group and the Securities America companies are unaffiliated.
If you're a new investor or an experienced one, staying on top of changes in the markets is key to not missing an opportunity for growth. We explore this and other topics in our brand new podcast called Dumb Questions for Smart Money, presented by the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Subscribe today on Apple, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast apps.
Chuck, Tucker, I guess really all of our listeners, I have an exciting job opportunity that has been open for, it looks like, more than 30 days. So I'm guessing they're getting pretty interested in hiring someone. Can I give you a brief description?
Absolutely.
Is it Wally the Green Monster?
It's not. this role will Tessie. Be managing a team of cybersecurity certified subject matter experts and specialists,
ooh,
as well as leading the development of the enterprise strategy for cybersecurity.
Enterprise.
They'll oversee the development of standards and processes for cybersecurity, lead the recovery from security incidents.
That sounds good.
And guide forensics of incidents. Any guesses which company has been trying to hire this position for more than 30 days?
Take a stab at it.
Yeah.
Good old Colonial Gas missed out on that hiring opportunity, unfortunately. Oh. I don't know why they didn't have this person. Hopefully they had somebody in this role prior to all this that left, but timing is everything, and I just found that. Somebody found this this job posting out there, and this made me laugh for quite some time, in spite of all the shortages we're seeing of gasoline across the country due to this cybersecurity incident.
And this is all reportedly because someone at Colonial, we don't know who, and we're not going to know who, someone clicked an email that gave these dark side hackers the ability to go in and lock everyone out of the system and shut down the pipeline.
Oopsie-daisy.
Pipeline did restart operations yesterday around 5 p.m. Eastern time, so the gas is flowing. Do either of you know how quickly the gasoline flows through the pipeline?
Fast.
I don't know. You have to guess the speed.
730 miles an hour.
You're completely insane.
Half the speed of a unicorn run.
I'm asking for the two of you to make a legitimate... Do you know how quickly gasoline flows through a pipeline? Specifically this one.
120 miles an hour.
Tucker?
730 miles an hour.
I'll stay.
5 miles an hour.
Oh. What?
You could walk this stuff to Boston faster than they actually pump it.
That's crazy.
What?
5 miles an hour.
Doesn't seem very efficient.
It is 5 miles an hour. That is the flow speed. So that means that the gas that
starts... That is hugely disappointing.
Right? So that means that the gas that's starting at one end of the pipeline right now... Remember, it's 4,500 miles long. Okay. 4,500 miles long, if you're moving at 5 miles an hour, that means it's going to take 900 hours to go from one end to the next, okay? Which means that it takes 37 days for starting it at one end and getting it all the way up to the other end.
Well, then...
Is it molasses? Like, that's crazy.
To be fair, it's a ton of gas.
I get that. I'm very, very surprised that I could walk faster than they can pump this gas.
Now, I'm not saying...
Even with rest time, I might be able to make it faster.
I'm not saying this is how all pipelines work, but this one moves at 5 miles an hour.
Interesting.
Very, very slow.
Did you all see the warning from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission yesterday?
I saw the video of the woman pouring gasoline into a plastic grocery bag Yep. So it was then leaking.
And then there was like the containers.
Fair, there has been a number of places that have gone and fact checked that and found out that some of these pictures were from several years ago and were not actually
still,
of current.
Doesn't matter.
But people are apparently filling plastic bags with gasoline, and the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission had to put out a warning there. Do not fill plastic bags with gasoline. It's a bad idea.
Honestly,
you know someone who's thinking about bringing a container not meant for fuel to get gas?
Well, Hefty will hold that.
Don't do it.
We're just so bad at this.
We are. Yeah.
Anytime. Last year, there's a pandemic coming. Buy all the toilet paper because all you're going to do is sit on the toilet. This year, hey, there's a gas pipeline out for 1 week. We're not going anywhere because of remote work, but let's load up on gas just in case. Gas sales in the Southeast were up 40% week over week for the first 3 days of this week.
Look, you know what? You want to fill up
They created the shortage by panicking.
Yeah. Look, I get, filling up the car, maybe filling up a tank of gas. But what are you doing filling up a grocery bag with gasoline? What planet are you on?
Well,
unbelievable.
I double knotted it, though, so I thought it would be fine.
Unbelievable.
We're just so bad at this.
At least it wasn't a paper bag.
We are so bad at this. There's nothing Americans do better than panic buy right now.
Yeah.
Quick break here on the Financial Exchange. We're back with more in a little bit.